I have one objective, and mine was to relate to everybody possible and say we're in some very serious conditions. I brought some material, and I urge everybody possible to spread it around, to consider these problems, and we'll see where it goes. If you make one session, we'll cover things pretty well tonight and outline. We'll get much more into it in the other three. There we go. That's her makes it. I got a few generations. So my sense of tonight, so we have some, you know, it's excellent equipment. I got some slides, four slides. We're going to use an easel and draw a number of diagrams. We'll have discussion going back and forth. At any point you feel you want to ask a question and make a point, I'm going to just go ahead and do that. And we'll work it through. We'll get through in an hour. Cover what we can. So I'll introduce myself a little bit. Then there's a little, there's part of this whole presentation I want to say in music, also at the end. Then we'll work, and I have a certain amount of printed material we can pass out, and some photographs. We'll send those around the middle. So basically, somebody says in 5 minutes or 1 minute, how do you put what's happening? A number of us in Berkeley and, well, here's the thing. I'm from the, let's start this one. An organization called Earth Regeneration Society. Reduce atmospheric carbon dioxide. And it refers to soil and forest and energy work to bring down the CO2 level. So you have a little person here with a shovel working away in the soil and planting trees and so on. This is a group that came together as a nonprofit corporation in 1983 in Berkeley. It's a board of directors of five. It's about 70 science people around the country who are associated in this effort in all different disciplines. And then a lot of us have connections in our community, environmental groups, trade union groups, business, political, Democratic Party, some Republicans are involved. So we're a catalyst. We came together and said we're going to try and get all the information we can, relate the science people involved here, because we began to realize that what's happening is a very full climate change going on and going very rapidly. And we've got to deal with it, and there are ways in which to deal with it, and that's what we'll discuss today. So we see that the rapidity, the rate at which there's increasing snow conditions, freezing temperatures coming down, heavy rain and flooding, crops being knocked out by intermittent hot and cold freezing spells, all of these things are coming more and more rapidly. We're going to be in very serious conditions, say in 15 to 20 years. We should be making every effort to try and stabilize. So that's the core of what we're about and what we'll talk about tonight. We've been in conferences here in other countries. I'm just back from Europe. We had 9 days in Budapest, Hungary. There was an international meeting with some of a systems group that looks at things from many ways and how things interact with each other. International Society for General Systems Research. We had about 250 people, and one of the workshops was on climate, what's happening with it. The Russians sent their top team of four people from their big computer center in Moscow. They're very concerned with what's happening. One of these people was actually on the team that did the nuclear winter studies in their country when we were doing it with people in the U.S. And they were doing it under Nikita Moiseev, the director of research, in their big computer center. That does the long-run planning. Remember they were thinking about changing some of their rivers to irrigate more agricultural land? And through this center, in the long-run planning, they decided it would change too much in the Arctic and in other environmental conditions, and this is the group that made the final decision and stopped that entire project out of the long-run environment considerations. So they're very much at the center of this kind of work. So now they're going to expand what they're doing on the climate problems. They're going to consider it and be developing this as a result of our meeting in Budapest. But we exchange a lot of things. So anyhow, the basic system kind of goes this way. We just come with a start with our own health and what's in the soil and what's in the crops we eat. We start there, or we can start what happens with the earth as a whole and all the ice ages over the last 2 million years. Okay, so we've got us right now, and we got the long run up here. Which way should we start? You'll leave it to me? Okay. Start the bar. Okay. We'll say this about our own health. We are very much dependent on the minerals in the soil, minerals and trace minerals. A trace mineral means maybe 1 or 2 cubic centimeters per acre. Very light, like zinc. But if you don't have a good level of zinc, arthritis comes on a lot faster. That's just one example. So we're going to write something here and say, soil, and we just put an S, the minerals in the soil get used up over time. Remember, what's in the soil is put there from the last glacial age. The grinding of rock and rock dust, and it's moving out by rivers and then by wind, spread around a good part of the earth. Now, well, we've always searched for some simple example. Trees, when they're growing and the roots are in the ground, are drawing on minerals, but they need the microorganisms of the soil, and the process brings that up into the tree as part of the growing process, essential to the function of a tree as it is for plants, animals, life, our lives, our health. Now, when a tree dies, just sort of sense how much of the mineral quality goes back in the soil and how much gets washed on down with the rains, the streams, and the ocean. So think over a long period of time, you're losing those minerals in the soil. And the biggest labs in the United States are New Knoxville, Ohio. And they handle over 1 million samples a year of soil from this country and many countries. And the director there has never added up all their data, but in discussions with him, he points out that by and large, think that it's down anywhere from 25 to 40%. A very serious drop in depletion of minerals in the soil. And that comes directly into what happens with our health. Now you think back around all the vitamins, and then go on beyond that, the minerals that we have to take as supplements very often, yeah. Compared to a rich standard that is there and has been in the past, and they find some soils that are still very high level and others with a depletion way down. And around the U.S. it varies a great deal, and different minerals vary a great deal.
Are we talking about zinc specifically or minerals as a
mineral? Well, each one has its own. One of our best soil samples had 80 different elements identified in their proportion. And that was a soil, rock dust from southern Utah called azomite. It's one of the best in the country. They've been selling it for 45 years for crops, poultry, sheep, and some even for human direct eating. So in the soil, now watch this. When the soils go down, what happened to the forests? So let's draw in an F for forests and show the rate of dying and put something like at least half the forests have been either cut down or are now dying in the last 2,000 years. We've heard so many stories of what's happening in Europe and in the northeast of this country. The sugar maples now up in Canada in the last 4 or 5 years. All right, now, when the forests are dying, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere starts going up rapidly. And here's something we don't get in our schools. When we're kids, we're coming through school. How much carbon is there in a tree, in a trunk, and branches? Well, the foresters at Berkeley tell us, I think 45%. So a tree is very much carbon. And it's taking it out of the air, obviously with photosynthesis every day when the sun's out through the process of the leaves. And remember the balance. Here we are back to a very basic balance in our lives. We breathe in the oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. When we exhale, the trees do the opposite. They're taking in CO2, heat the carbon, give back the oxygen. So here's a balance. But what's happening when this occurs, and the CO2 goes up? And here, let's just write in that it was about 280 parts per million up to the end of the beginning of this century. And for about the last 10,000 years of the interglacial period, it's been staying that or lower. Now, it's gone up rapidly, and from the 280, it's up to about 347 parts per million. Now, what's that mean? You don't see it, it's not a pollutant, and that's a very small part of the atmosphere. Per million, that's a fraction of a percent. But the point is, when it rises from one level to another, as it has in the last 80 years, it has a very significant sort of a trigger situation in there. We can talk about that just a little more later, but go on here and point out that, now let's stop. What happens when there's more carbon in the air? Let's make a simple statement on that. Take the surface of the earth, and when the sun's rays hit the earth and becomes warmer, especially down Mexico, Central America, and the lower latitudes. When it hits there, it heats and radiates heat back toward the atmosphere, and if there's a lot more carbon here, it's caught and held and even reflected back, and the whole area gets warmer. And that's what's been going on. This jump here means a lot more warming. You've heard the greenhouse effect idea. But that means a lot more water gets evaporated, in the ocean primarily. And so here's, well, we'll just say W for water here, water vapor. And the key thing is, what happens when that rises and starts moving out in the wind currents of the world, and starts getting to the high latitudes and hits cold areas up there. Like steam off a stove. You know, when it moves out and hits, it's, maybe you don't see as it comes up, but if it moves out and hits colder air in the room, it condenses. So here we're getting into the question of weather and tremendous changes going on there. Because that extra moisture going out there, to me, more cloud cover, like the Great Lakes area, much more snow falling, much more in the way of floods and storms. If we draw a picture of the earth and we visualize the snow collecting further and further down, and from 1973 to 85, and they use the month of November. And these are, I'm referring now to satellite readings. How much snow is there around? In that one period, it increased 18% over the highest recorded for 73. And here came 85 with a tremendous increase. And that's the same over North America, Europe, and the Soviet Union. Remember, there are 11 time zones there. We're three. So as this is coming down, and as you're having more and more heating happen from the extra carbon, you're that cold and the hot get closer together, and so what happens? What happens to all the air movements? Yeah, the tornadoes, the increase in tornadoes, their destructiveness is worse. When they're cutting through pieces of towns back east and Well, we're just constantly getting clippings about like 15,000 people out of utilities and so a few loss of lives and injuries, a lot of homes knocked out. This stuff's increasing rapidly. That's just one part of the whole picture. Also, what happens if you're living about in here or just below the area? Snow melts off in the summer. And you're, say, 500 or 700 miles up in Canada from the border. What happens when you have late floods, storms and flooding and early frosts? Can you grow crops? It's getting harder and harder to bring a crop through to maturity. Another side of the crop problem, some friends from Chicago are pointing out, and also Minnesota area. If you're going into spring, it starts to get warm. You have a warm spell. And so your buds are coming out, the blossoms are coming out, and then all of a sudden you get a freezing spell come down on them, or a very heavy rainstorm, and you knock all the blossoms off, or freeze and kill the buds. So you lose a good part of the crop. This is the kind of thing that's happening more and more rapidly.
It would seem like you're increasing the CO2 content in the air and you're warming climate further up north. That would enhance crop production. Two ways, because you increase the temperature, and secondly, because CO2 is a nutrient. It seems like that is having the opposite, could have the opposite effect for what you're suggesting. Kind of a beneficial effect for growing crops.
Well, you've raised two interesting points. One, when warmer air masses with it, extra moisture, get up in the higher altitudes, up here, latitudes, such as Central Alaska, they're going to condense and come down. The snow cover in Central Alaska below the mountains is getting far deeper and lasting longer into the spring. The same is happening in parts of Canada very much and in Europe. Now, instead of, say, 20, 30, or 40 below zero, maybe it's 2 or 3 degrees less below zero, but it's still way down, and the snows are building rapidly. See, that's a sense of how the system is happening. Now, this question of CO2 helping growth. If the soil is sufficient, then this is an assist to growth. So it's up to a point. But now in Europe, so much of Europe and many of the forests are dying rapidly. So extra CO2 is no help because the soil conditions are so bad. And when we were there, some of our group went out and toured Hungary and came back and said almost all the forests in this country are dying now. And a few days later, we arranged a meeting with the Minister of Industry. And he, when we brought with us the delegation from Austria, and in Austria they're doing the best job of putting rock dust back in the soil, dolomite rock, this the very good mineral cross-section in that. And their forests are coming back to life. They're doing that more than any other place right now. So the Hungarians are setting up a team, they're going to work with the Austrians, they're going to start doing this in Hungary, and that was the agreement when we were there. And their objective is to help this spread out in other countries in Central Europe, and it's obvious for anybody, for us, of course, as well. So now, just for further illustration of some of the background of this stuff, let me put these four slides on. This has two diagrams. One is the standard sort of curve for CO2. Here's the beginning of our century, from the 280 level on up to 345 a year or so ago, and at 84. The objective now is to slow that rise, level it off, and try and bring it back down. Until it's back down somewhere in this level, we're going to have continuing snow buildup and more intense cold fronts and intense drought and heat in different places in the summer. So here's our problem. When this was first drawn, we showed the year 2000 as a place of trying to turn it around. But we've got something much more imminent, something we have to do much faster than that. Now here's kind of a basic diagram of climate movement and what's happening, what we call
the full cycle. You have the increase in CO2, the warming action we referred to in the lower latitudes. And so if you think up in terms of heat, additional increase here in heat around those areas, and more warm, moist air being taken up into the higher altitudes and moving around the world's air currents. As it moves toward the poles, you're going to have far more cloud formation. The state of Illinois, for example, has put out an excellent report and showed great increase over the last 8 years. Further north, well, let's take this. The more you have clouds, the more that's going to take the energy from the sun and reflect it back to outer space, and it does not get to the surface of the Earth. That means a further cooling effect. Now, when it condenses and falls, you get great builds up here of snow and slowly of ice formation. And as you build up more weight on the poles with this increasing snow, so what's going to happen? In the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a lot more scientific analysis of what goes on the surface of the Earth, the plates, the basic plates on which the continents are part, the tectonic plates. So they're moving, and they allow certain movement under pressure. So the more weight on them, the more tendency towards earthquakes and volcanoes. And here we've seen in the last 15 years, in Managua, in Nicaragua, in Mexico, and up and down our own coast. So, when volcanoes erupt, like St. Helens, there's a lot more CO2 thrown out, as well as particles and mineral particles. Now, when you have bigger sheets of snow across the hemisphere, a lot more cold air and cold masses are going to come down, like clear to Florida, knocking out citrus. And it's important to mention that that the whole Cape Canaveral tragedy was on one of the coldest mornings Florida had had. They tell us around 28 degrees Fahrenheit, where the fuel was for 40 degrees or above. And there, at the time, we know, there's been no general discussion in this country about the full climate change and what that means, and we have to watch out and respond and try and protect ourselves. So here's these cold fronts coming down. Move, clear. We can illustrate it by how many people saw the pictures of snow in Arabia for the first time in their known history? Saudi Arabia. Southern Italy has had snow that they've never seen before, according to just popular knowledge. So that's what's happening here, and the effect is greater and greater loss of food crops. So here is the full cycle now. It's increasing and speeding up, and there lies the emergency nature of the whole process. And that's why we're here. Now, why isn't this in the media throughout the U.S.? And the main reason is this, that in the 60s and 70s, there was considerable discussion of the whole cooling process and what's happening. In the U.S., the CIA Research Department put out a report in August of 1974 saying the climate is changing, food supplies will be knocked out, and governments destabilized. Now, that report was prepared in Wisconsin, primarily at the Maine Climate Institute there under Professor Reed Bryson, whom we know well. 2 years later, some of the top policy people in the country in the Oil Investors Association, Rothschilds, Rockefellers, Scripps, and a number of finance people, sort of behind, think of the whole operation here that we're hearing about on television, of the Contragate, Irangate, and all of this. There's a pretty strong nucleus of people determining policy. And this was one of the main decisions. Don't let the public have a full discussion of what is going on. Cut it in the middle and just refer to warming, that CO2 warming and stop there and say, oh, it'll melt the pole someday and raise the oceans, but don't worry. Now, a beautiful example, or a clear example of this. In 1984, there's a meeting in San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel of the International Association of Energy Economists, over 300. They had a session on climate. I gave the main paper in that session, and mine was on the general system of the whole problem. Others were dealing with minor aspects of it. I spoke from a floor in one of the large workshops about the general problem we're facing. Immediately, a man up at the podium jumped to the mic. This was the chief economist for Chevron Oil. His response was, we know that CO2 is causing warming, it's going to melt the pole someday, raise the oceans a little, but you don't have to change any of the coefficients in your models now. Now, that was just 3 years ago. He was still saying this perfect cover story, 8 years after that original decision. The next day, his boss, the chairman of the board of Chevron Oil, gave the main address. And afterwards, I talked with him at some length, and he says, I don't know about all this warming and cooling that's going on, but give your stuff to our staff. We want to consider it. So he was not involved in that cover story. But that whole situation, like this, of cutting it for 10 years, and this is something we should know just as ABCs. For 10 years, the federal government, through their main agencies, only the Department of Energy, Environment Protection Administration, those two agencies gave money to people on climate work, only those that would say, it's just warming, and now we go on about our work, including the main computer center in Colorado. Now, it's important for us to know in sense of our own survival and the rate at which this is all happening. Now, Europe is far more clear on this, and we'll talk about that another session. Our survival is the main reason that we came together in this Earth Regeneration Society. We know, and we've been in touch with some of the top Class A scientists, such as Kovda, the soil person, Draymanis in Canada, another name, Bertrand Schultz in the United States, who's head of the Academy of Science in Nebraska, and head of the main institute in this country dealing with glaciation. He says we're clearly into a cooling. He was part of a group that gave papers saying this a year ago in Philadelphia, which, by the way, the seminar at that time was organized by our group. So there's a few middle-level administrators have been pushing this warming-only story. We have to bring as full a possible understanding of it and evaluation to the public as a whole and go for federal legislation to try and counter and what is happening and stabilize. And we've been part of our group are some of the finest foresters at Berkeley, like Paul Zinke. And there's a sense, how fast do forests grow? See, now we're back to ABCs. This is something I knew almost nothing about a couple of years ago. Net growth rate of forests is talked about by the foresters, including one of our friends here who left yesterday or this morning, who's a forester from England. They deal with cubic meters per hectare per year. Now, you know, like 2.4 acres. So this is the kind of unit they talk about. And the net growth rate, as forests die and new trees are growing, so they talk of net growth rate. Now, down where the fastest growing forests are, which is closer to the equator, equatorial, the big tropical forests, the figure, anybody want to guess? Anybody here want to hazard a figure? How many cubic meters per hectare per year? We've had high school classes give guesses, you know, and they go all over the map. Well, it's about 15. Now, you go up to Finland, we're told it's about 2 because of the cold weather, the poor soil, and so on. And he said for an average, for an international program to rebuild for us, to try and stabilize this situation here, use a figure of about 10. So starting 3 years ago, the group did run through the analysis of how much acreage or square kilometers of new forest you've got to do per year to bring that CO2 down. And the numbers, there are numbers that we've been using, such as, and I don't expect anybody to be familiar with this, it's like 90 times 10 to the 15th grams, or something like 60 by 60 miles and like three stories deep of Earth, something like this. This is the amount of extra carbon in the world's atmosphere. Now, if you're growing forests at certain rates, then there's two things. One, you plant new trees, especially in the areas where they grow the best. And secondly, you remineralize the soil where the minerals are badly down. You remineralize with good rock dust and bring them back faster. So you got two kinds of growth. So this is the sort of the basics in it and the simple logic of how to make our best effort in the years to come. Now let me just jump ahead here and pick up a couple other diagrams. Here's one that said, okay, the science research tells us about what's been happening with carbon dioxide count. Here we are in the 200 to 250 range for 140,000 years. Here we are sitting here tonight, the present time. You go back about 120, 150, 120 some thousand years, and there is a turnaround from interglacial, from warm weather, into a new glacial period. Here we are, we've been through our 10,000 years plus, the CO2 has jumped up here to almost 350, and we're going in, we're halfway through something like this, a transition into the next one. Here's a history of the world's global ice that melts off in the interglacial. It melts off, starts about 18,000 years ago. And down about 11, there's a blip, and about 10,000, it stayed down in here, and now it's starting up. One of our top glaciologists, Gifford Miller from Colorado, has done a lot of work up in northern Canada, in Baffin Island, Spitsbergen, and over in Europe. And he was on television 10 years ago saying the snow is deeper, and it's coming faster, and the ice is moving, and the ice is building. This is where you see the beginning of a new glacial period building up, and it is going. So we have a copy of that tape, and that's public information, and well, that tells a little about this situation. Then here's sort of a history of the world's temperatures from special measurements back over time. A lot of this is from ocean core drillings. So without going into the details, that just shows you the areas the different science groups have been working on. Yep, let's go. All right, now, anybody want to memorize that in a short spell? All right, there's a very good person in the System Society down in Argentina. He put all this together, and the objective is to say, you got problems with forests and plant life and CO2 in the glacial period, and there's many, many things that have feedback loops. If the soil minerals go down, for example, and the forests start dying, they're much more susceptible to forest fires. They can't resist it as much. They burn faster. As you can say, any bunch of dry tinder will burn faster. And they're much more susceptible to pests, like the, well, take the elm trees in the U.S. So you can see a whole number of things which we refer to as feedback loops. These speed up the process. And we have copies of this sort of thing if somebody wants to pursue it further. But I just put it up there to show you the kind of breadth of a system society, a systems approach, to try and bring in all the main variables that affect the thing and are moving it along so you can figure which ones are the most impact, and what do we do about it. Here's kind of a last diagram, and then we get back on the board. This is a way to show something very symbolically, and it says this. Here we are now, here is the world's population. If we start now with a maximum employment program in this country around soil and forest and alternative energy work and conservation, good solar and wind, hydrogen fuel, gasoline fuel, the whole range of possibilities. If we start now on an international program, like a CO2 budget for the world by regions, what we do year by year. Now that's what came out of the Budapest meeting, discussions of this approach. If you do that in a maximum program, building up and run it for quite a few years, we'll be making our best effort. At the same time, if you don't do that, the increase of CO2 and its effect on the intensities of climate in the summer and winter are going to be knocking down the world's population, and we're pretty much all at risk if we don't move on it. And that means who is going to survive if crops don't come to fruition for a period of time. It takes a very short time when you don't have food. So this is what we're facing, and this is the kind of program we've got to mount and work on. I think they'll come on, even though we got the lights on in the room. Here's the first one. Is that clear enough? Namely, you can see the words and the movement of the lines. Okay? You want to? Okay. A little sharper. Hey, Aaron, come on in. This has two diagrams. One is the standard sort of curve for CO2. Here's the beginning of our century, from the 280 level on up to 345 a year or so ago, and at 84. The objective now is to slow that rise, level it off, and try and bring it back down. Until it's back down somewhere in this level, we're going to have continuing snow buildup and more intense cold fronts and intense drought and heat in different places in the summer. So here's our problem. When this was first drawn, we showed the year 2000 as a place of trying to turn it around. But we've got something much more imminent, something we have to do much faster than that. Now here's kind of a basic diagram of climate movement and what's happening, what we call the full cycle. You have the increase in CO2, the warming action we referred to in the lower latitudes, and so if you think up in terms of heat, additional increase here in heat around those areas, and more warm, moist air being taken up into the higher altitudes and moving around the world's air currents. As it moves toward the poles, you're going to have far more cloud formation. The state of Illinois, for example, has put out an excellent report and showed great increase over the last 8 years. Further north, well, let's take this. The more you have clouds, the more that's going to take the energy from the sun and reflect it back to outer space, and it does not get to the surface of the Earth. That means a further cooling effect. Now, when it condenses and falls, you get great builds up here of snow and slowly of ice formation. And as you build up more weight on the poles with this increasing snow, so what's going to happen? In the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a lot more scientific analysis of what goes on the surface of the Earth, the plates, the basic plates on which the continents are part, the tectonic plates. So they're moving. And they allow certain movement under pressure. So the more weight on them, the more tendency towards earthquakes and volcanoes. And here we've seen in the last 15 years in Managua and Nicaragua and Mexico and up and down our own coast. So when volcanoes erupt, like St. Helens, there's a lot more CO2 thrown out, as well as particles and mineral particles. Now, when you have bigger sheets of snow across the hemisphere, a lot more cold air and cold masses are going to come down, like clear to Florida, knocking out citrus. And it's important to mention that in passing that the whole Cape Canaveral tragedy was on one of the coldest mornings Florida had had. They tell us around 28 degrees Fahrenheit, where the fuel was for 40 degrees or above. And there, at the time, we know, there's been no general discussion in this country about the full climate change and what that means, and we have to watch out and respond and try and protect ourselves. So here's these cold fronts coming down. Move, clear. We can illustrate it by how many people saw the pictures of snow in Arabia for the first time in their known history. Saudi Arabia. Southern Italy has had snow that they've never seen before, and according to just popular knowledge. So that's what's happening here, and the effect is greater and greater loss of food crops. So here is the full cycle now. It's increasing and speeding up, and there lies the emergency nature of the whole process. And that's why we're here. Now, why isn't this in the media throughout the U.S.? And the main reason is this, that in the 60s and 70s, there was considerable discussion of the whole cooling process and what's happening. In the U.S., the CIA Research Department put out a report in August of 1974 saying the climate is changing, food supplies will be knocked out, and governments destabilized. Now, that report was prepared in Wisconsin, primarily at the Maine Climate Institute there under Professor Reed Bryson, whom we know well. 2 years later, some of the top policy people in the country in the Oil Investors Association, Rothschilds, Rockefellers, Scripps, and a number of finance people, and sort of behind, think of the whole operation here that we're hearing about on television, of the Contragate, Irangate, and all of this. There's a pretty strong nucleus of people determining policy. And this was one of the main decisions. Don't let the public have a full discussion of what is going on. Cut it in the middle and just refer to warming, that CO2 warming, and stop there and say, oh, it'll melt the pole someday and raise the oceans, but don't worry. Now, a beautiful example, or a clear example of this. In 1984, there was a meeting in San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel of the International Association of Energy Economists, over 300. They had a session on climate. I gave the main paper in that session, and mine was on the general system of the whole problem. Others were dealing with minor aspects of it. A little later in that conference, I spoke from a floor in one of the large workshops about the general problem we're facing. Immediately, a man up at the podium jumped to the mic. This was the chief economist for Chevron Oil. His response was, we know that CO2 is causing warming. It's going to melt the pole someday, raise the oceans a little, but you don't have to change any of the coefficients in your models now. Now, that was just 3 years ago. He was still saying this perfect cover story, 76 for 8 years after that original decision. The next day, his boss, the chairman of the board of Chevron Oil, gave the main address. And afterwards, I talked with him at some length, and he says, I don't know about all this warming and cooling that's going on, but give your stuff to our staff. We want to consider it. So he was not involved in that cover story. But that whole situation, like this, of cutting it, for 10 years, and this is something we should know just as ABCs, for 10 years, the federal government, through their main agencies, only the Department of Energy, Environment Protection Administration, those two agencies gave money to people on climate work, only those that would say, it's just warming, and now we go on about our work, including the main computer center in Colorado. Now, it's important for us to know in sense of our own survival and the rate at which this is all happening. Now, Europe is far more clear on this, and we'll talk about that at another session. Our survival is the main reason that we came together in this Earth Regeneration Society. We know, and we've been in touch with some of the top Class A scientists, such as Kovda, the Soviet soil person, Draymanis in Canada, another name, Bertrand Schultz in the United States, who's head of the Academy of Science in Nebraska, and head of the main institute in this country dealing with glaciation. He says we're clearly into a cooling. He was part of a group that gave papers saying this a year ago in Philadelphia, which, by the way, the seminar at that time was organized by our group. So there's a few middle-level administrators have been pushing this warming-only story. We have to bring as full a possible understanding of it and evaluation to the public as a whole and go for federal legislation to try and counter and what is happening and stabilize. And we've been part of our group are some of the finest foresters at Berkeley, like Paul Zinke. And there's a sense, how fast do forests grow? See, now we're back to ABCs. This is something I knew almost nothing about as a couple of years ago. Net growth rate of forests is talked about by the foresters, including one of our friends here who left yesterday or this morning, who's a forester from England. They deal with cubic meters per hectare per year. Now, you know, like 2.4 acres. So this is the kind of unit they talk about. And the net growth rate, as forests die and new trees are growing, so they talk of net growth rate. Now, down where the fastest growing forests are, which is closer to the equator, equatorial, the big tropical forests, the figure, anybody want to guess? Anybody here want to hazard a figure? How many cubic meters per hectare per year? We've had high school classes give guesses, you know, and they go all over the map. Well, it's about 15. Now, you go up to Finland, we're told it's about 2, because of the cold weather, the poor soil, and so on. And they said for an average, for an international program to rebuild forests, to try and stabilize this situation here, use a figure of about 10. So starting 3 years ago, the group did run through the analysis of how much acreage or square kilometers of new forest you've got to do per year to bring that CO2 down. And the numbers, there are numbers that we've been using, such as, and I don't expect anybody to be familiar with this, it's like 90 times 10 to the 15th grams, or something like 60 by 60 miles and like 3 stories deep of Earth, something like this. This is the amount of extra carbon in the world's atmosphere. Now, if you're growing forests at certain rates, then there's two things. One, you plant new trees, especially in the areas where they grow the best. And secondly, you remineralize the soil where the minerals are badly down. You remineralize with good rock dust and bring them back faster. So you got two kinds of growth. So this is the sort of the basics in it and the simple logic of how to make our best effort in the years to come. Now let me just jump ahead here and pick up a couple other diagrams. Here's one that said, okay, the science research tells us about what's been happening with carbon dioxide count. Here we are in the 200 to 250 range for 140,000 years. Here we are sitting here tonight, the present time. You go back about 120, 150, 120 some thousand years, and there is a turnaround from interglacial, from warm weather, into a new glacial period. Here we are, we've been through our 10,000 years plus. The CO2 has jumped up here to almost 350, and we're halfway through something like this, a transition into the next one. Here's a history of the world's global ice that melts off in the interglacial, melts off, starts about 18,000 years ago. And down about 11, there's a blip, and about 10,000, it stayed down in here, and now it's starting up. One of our top glaciologists, Gifford Miller from Colorado, has done a lot of work up in northern Canada, in Baffin Island, Spitsbergen, over in Europe. And he was on television 10 years ago saying the snow is deeper and it's coming faster and the ice is moving and the ice is building. This is where you see the beginning of a new glacial period building up, and it is going. So we have a copy of that tape, and that's public information. And well, that tells a little about this situation. Then here's sort of a history of the world's temperatures from special measurements back over time. A lot of this is from ocean core drillings. So without going into the details, that just shows you the areas the different science groups have been working on. All right, now, anybody want to memorize that in a short spell? All right, there's a very good person in the System Society down in Argentina. He put all this together, and the objective is to say, you got problems with forests and plant life and CO2 in the glacial period, and there's many, many things that have feedback loops. If the soil minerals go down, for example, and the forests start dying, they're much more susceptible to forest fires. They can't resist it as much. They burn faster. As you can say, any bunch of dry tinder will burn faster. And they're much more susceptible to pests, like the, well, take the elm trees in the U.S. So you can see a whole number of things which we refer to as feedback loops. These speed up the process. And we have copies of this sort of thing if somebody wants to pursue it further. But I just put it up there to show you the kind of breadth of a system society, a systems approach, to try and bring in all the main variables that affect the thing and are moving it along so you can figure which ones are the most impact, and what do we do about it. Here's kind of a last diagram, and then we get back on the board. This is a way to show something very symbolically, and it says this. Here we are now. Here is the world's population. If we start now with a maximum employment program in this country around soil and forest and alternative energy work and conservation, good solar and wind, hydrogen fuel, gasoline fuel, the whole range of possibilities. If we start now on an international program, like a CO2 budget for the world by regions, what we do year by year. Now that's what came out of the Budapest meeting, discussions of this approach. If you do that in a maximum program, building up and run it for quite a few years, we'll be making our best effort. At the same time, if you don't do that, the increase of CO2 and its effect on the intensities of climate in the summer and winter are going to be knocking down the world's population, and we're pretty much all at risk if we don't move on it. And that means who is going to survive if crops don't come to fruition for a period of time. It takes a very short time when you don't have food. So this is what we're facing, and this is the kind of program we've got to mount and work on.